morning. This is, well, the leader is John Dyer. He holds a master's in theology from Dallas Theological Seminary, where he's a director of web development. John is also does web development for individual clients, contributes to several open source projects, builds ministry resources such as bestcommentaries.com, blogs about technology and faith, and don'teatthefruit.com. He and his beautiful wife, Amber, are living in Irvine, Texas, with their awesome new son, Benjamin. John is kicking off our Saturday presentation with a presentation called Technology is Not Neutral, How Bible Technology Shapes Our Faith. John Dyer.
Well, thanks so much for having me, guys. I looked at Stephen Smith's presentation. It looked really, really interesting, so I'm glad you guys came over here because I actually really wanted to go over to his. So I appreciate you guys showing up to talk about something a little bit different than most of the rest of the presentations. And to give you a little bit more information about me before you guys skewer me with questions or whatever, this is my beautiful wife, Amber, and my new little son, Benjamin, who didn't sleep very well last night, so I have a little bit of a cold because he was up in the room and he didn't sleep super well. But my job is the director of web development at Dallas Seminary, but even though I have a director title, I really do HTML and JavaScript and PHP and ASP.NET and all that stuff. So I'm basically a code guy, and they put me in a basement like all other good code guys down there at the seminary. And the kinds of things I do, I make their main website that every school has. We also work on some online education apps, and this is an online education video player that we record all the video and PowerPoint slides and transcripts and convert them all to multilingual, so there's a bunch of students all around the world using this stuff in different languages. And then, like we mentioned earlier, this is a site called Best Commentaries, which takes about 2,000 or 3,000 commentaries and several thousand reviews and kind of aggregates them to kind of make a dig for commentaries with a cute little 3D thing at the top for the books, and you can see a little aggregate score along the right. And I also want to show you one other tool that we developed for Dallas Seminary students that is kind of the background for this talk. And this is a little tool. It's a Greek and Hebrew Reader's Bible, and it does all the things that you would expect from a Bible software. Let me get my mouse over here. You know, where you can put your mouse over things, and you can get definitions and all that, and it'll work for both Greek and Hebrew. And you can do all kinds of syntax highlighting and all the fun stuff that you would get from any sort of Bible software. But the main goal of this was to be able to let students just get the information they need and take off things that they don't need, and to be able to put out something where they could actually print out just the definitions they needed for words with a certain frequency. So if they had memorized down to 30, they could do that. Or if they really weren't doing too well and they needed it all the way up to 80, they could do that really quickly. And if they needed, say, the morphology in addition to all the other things, they could get that and then print that out and not spend time like I did when I was in seminary. I often spent time, and as I was translated, I kind of just went like this, and then like that, and then like that, and like that. So the idea here is that they would print it out and be able to work on something. So it's kind of this hybrid between having something that's fairly technically advanced, but also allows someone to spend time away from the technology to be able to do something that so they're not so dependent on it. And so the reason why I had done this was that over the last few years of being in seminary and looking around and thinking about the world, and I thought, I wonder if there is anybody writing on the concept of what technology is from like a theological perspective. And when I looked around, what I would find is all the guys talking, doing exactly what I was doing, saying, how can I use technology for ministry? So there's all this great tech out there. We must use it for ministry. But then at the same time, I was looking in the business world and the tech world, and there was all these discussions about, should we really be using email for this? Or companies saying, maybe we should shut down email on Friday to be more efficient, because sometimes this is actually making us less and less efficient, and people are being too busy. And then I saw an article last summer in the Atlantic Monthly from Nicholas Carr, who's a tech and IT writer, asking the question, is Google making us stupid? And he's basically thinking, all this information out there, all this searching, all this stuff that we're doing, are we really kind of reducing our intelligence on the basis of that and kind of becoming dependent on this stuff? And so I started to think about this, and then I had a prof in a class, and he had this statement that technology is not neutral. And he said that's the, kind of one of the greatest myths that you can believe in, is that technology is really neutral. And then I thought, I'm going to ask this guy about this, because that doesn't make any sense to me to say that technology is not neutral. Of course it's neutral. But the next day, he got like a blood clot and had to go into hospital, and he was out, and he never returned to the classroom. And so I thought, how in the world am I going to find out about this stuff? And so I looked around, and eventually I started finding authors like Neil Postman and Marshall McLuhan and some of the philosophers like Heidegger and some of the more recent philosophers like Borgman, and even a pastor named Shane Hipps, who's kind of writing about these things. And so for us, I thought it would be really fun to talk with developers and guys in Bible technology about all of this stuff, and kind of just share it with you guys and see kind of how, what you guys think about it, so that as we continue to develop all of these things that we're developing, that we would do it kind of from an informed view. So the way that we're going to do this is we're going to look a little bit at technology and society in kind of a broad view, not cover everything, because there's no way we could cover Facebook and all the different things that we could talk about. And then focus in a little bit on the concept of a medium and how that affects a message. And then toward the latter part, we'll look through Bible and technology and kind of look at the history of Bible technology. And we'll do all that in the next 35 minutes. So that's what we're going to try to do. So our normal categories for technology, because they don't really fit into good or bad, we just sort of assume that they're neutral. I mean, maybe like a torture device we could say is inherently bad, but pretty much everything we say it's neutral, and we kind of talk about it's just how we use the technology. But I want to do a little social experiment on this. If we talk about the mobile phone, a lot of us probably have iPhones here. We normally think of it as being neutral, so that if we call a friend, that's probably kind of a good use of it. And if we call in a bomb threat, that would sort of be a bad use of it, right? Okay, but I want to do a little social experiment here. I want you to think about how many telephone numbers you know by heart in your head. Okay, so I know 5 telephone numbers. I know my home phone, my cell phone, my office phone, and I know also my wife's number and my mom's number. So I want to see, does anybody know more than 5? Anybody know? Okay, more than 7? More than 8? More than 12? More than 20? How many do you know back there?
I know it's more than
1. Do you have 20 off the top of your head?
Sure.
And then?
Yeah, although most of them are useless. Like, I know my grandparents' phone number from that place 10 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
I have no idea what their phone number is today, but back when I had to memorize the number,
yeah.
I know those numbers still.
Yeah. So there's a lot of things where I probably think of myself as knowing about 5 now, but when I was in high school, I probably knew 2 or 3 dozen phone numbers. And a lot of those were pizza places and stuff like that was really nerdy to know about, but I knew a lot of those, and now I don't, because I don't have to, because I have them all. I have like probably 500 or something like that in the device. And so this is kind of an example of where the phone is. Of course, it's morally neutral. It's not immoral or bad or good. I'm not going to get a crown in heaven or a little bit hotter flame in hell if I use a phone. So it's not morally bad. But in the same time, we would probably say it's not really effectively neutral. So it has these effects on us, like, for example, we tend to know fewer numbers, except for a couple of you stellar super memory guys that are in the room. Most of us know fewer numbers. And again, that's not really a big deal. In a lot of ways, I think, man, that frees me up to know other things. But in reality, just like someone, say, a couple hundred years ago who did a lot of outside exercise with their work in an agrarian culture, now most of us are kind of a little bit chubbier than we might have been if we had worked outdoors. So we have to go and exercise our body to keep it in shape. So in the same way, we're starting to see that it seems as though their minds are being affected a little bit, because they're no longer exercising it on these simple things, so that the big things, it's changing the way that they think. In the same way that the ability to be constantly accessible is really, really awesome, so that I can contact my wife anytime during the day, or she can call me if something happens with the baby. But at the same time, if my wife and I are out on a date, anyone can call me at the same time. So this is kind of the idea that it's not that it's good or it's bad, but it certainly isn't neutral. To give you a kind of another example, we could talk a little bit about the automobile. This is apparently a light that's somewhere in Europe, so if you ever want to look it up, that's what it is. We normally think of the car as being neutral, and again, we think about driving to church being a good thing, driving over a person being a bad thing, a bad use of the vehicle. But in reality, the automobile is probably one of the things that is also not at all neutral, where in one way it would have basically eliminated the job of a blacksmith, because they no longer were needed to develop wagons or make horseshoes. So Neil Postman says that technology creates winners and losers. When it enters into a society, it alters it in a way that some people win and some people lose. Thankfully, most of us are in tech, so we're almost always the winners, right? So at my own school, when the economic downturn went a little bit, they had to cut a few staff. It certainly didn't cut my job, because I'm a winner in the technological game, but other people got cut. In addition, you see all of the landscape of America has been changed since Eisenhower, with all the jobs and roads and laws and all those kinds of things. And also, for all the things that the vehicle does to connect us to one another, it's also the very thing that separates us from one another. So Sigmund Freud said something. He said, I'm so glad for the telephone that lets me call my son who's overseas, but I'm really sad about the steamboat that took him there. So his idea is to say that there's all these things that do connect us, but in reality, they're the things that also separate us. So I work down in Dallas, but I live up in Irving, and my best friend's up in Melissa, Texas, and my other one's over in Dubai around the world. And so I think, man, I'm really in a way disconnected, even though I'm able to be connected with this vehicle. So these are just the ideas that we would say that normally we think of technology as being how you use it, but the reality is that it's actually that we use it that it alters and shapes and forms society and the kinds of relationships we have in the areas that we go to, the schools that we attend, the churches that we go to. And this is what we mean by the idea that technology is not neutral. So our second topic is to talk a little bit about the idea of a medium. So a medium is when we take anything that's like an idea in our head and we're going to transfer that to somebody else. So we would use the medium of language and verbal speaking to talk to somebody. We might use an image to convey something. We might use email or text messaging or any of these different mediums to communicate something. But one of the fascinating things that you find out when you study this stuff is that each medium in and of itself has the ability to communicate something to someone. So let me give you an example. If you read this slide, it says, I am awesome at PowerPoint. Now probably if you were to evaluate whether or not you believed that sentence there on the basis of this medium, you probably wouldn't believe it. Because the medium itself of the worst possible color combinations and the silliest graphic I could find kind of communicate something to you other than the words. And this is true of anything, even when a person speaks and says something like this, humble yourself before the Lord and don't bring attention to yourself. If this guy says it, you probably would not really know what to think about that. Similarly, you might see something where a kid today text messages their friends and all that kind of thing. Now, if a 16-year-old guy decides he wants to date somebody else and he sits this girl down and he says, it's not you, it's me, I think we need to break up and just be friends. She's going to be sad, you know, she's going to walk away. But if he does that via text message, he says the exact same words, it's not you, it's me, I just want to be friends, ! She's going to take that really, really differently, right? Because the medium is going to communicate something to her other than what it would have if she had done it face to face. So mediums themselves are really, really important for us to be thinking about how each of the mediums we use communicates to people and how that reforms society. So that guy we were talking about a minute ago, Marshall McLuhan, his big statement was, the medium is the message. And he would say kind of crazy things like, the words you say are as important as the writing on the outside of a nuclear bomb as it flies down and blows up a city in Japan. The words are that unimportant, that the medium is that important. Now, he's obviously kind of a prophetic speaker. He speaks in big terms that are a little bit overstating the case, but really kind of gets you thinking about how mediums do things. And of course, there's mediums in the scriptures as well. We all know about genre, we know about poetry, we know about narrative and apocalypse, we know about gospels, we know about epistles. We know all those things kind of shape and alter the message of the person who's speaking. But there's also other fun mediums that are kind of smattered throughout the scriptures, like the talking donkey in Numbers, that this is an ass that's communicating to someone how asinine they're being, right? So it has a different message than just the words, because this donkey's talking to Balaam. Also, the burning bush, God says, I'm Yahweh, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but he does it through this really mysterious, wonderful, kind of holy ground thing that communicates probably a lot more than just the words that he said to Moses. Communicates something about who he is and what kind of God he is and what he's going to expect of Moses. And of course, the ultimate medium that God uses is, of course, God in the flesh. That God coming down and being a man in the Son of God really communicates something to us far beyond even the sermons that he gave, but that him being in the flesh and talking to us, that communicates ultimately about who God is. And the scriptures constantly talk about how this is the fullness of the revelation of God, that we see him most clearly in Jesus Christ. So I want to give you a little set of tools that we can use when we're evaluating media like this, and then we'll apply this to Bible technology. McLuhan gave us this idea of these four laws of media that we could use when we look at a medium. So we ask these questions. We say, what does this medium extend? So the idea is with a car or something like that, we might say this extends our ability to travel, or of the human body, it extends kind of our feet and our ability to walk. So it takes us somewhere else. The next question is, what does it make obsolete? So in a way, it makes obsolete the wagon, the horse, all of the previous things that came before that. But another way, it also kind of makes obsolete kind of our ability to walk as well. So most of us don't spend as much time walking and traveling. Similarly, a microphone like this is going to extend my voice, but it's also going to make obsolete the person who's able to project their voice on their own. So I've never learned how to project my voice because I've always had a microphone, because it makes that obsolete. The next one, though, is to talk about what does it retrieve from a prior era that was maybe lost at a certain time. So the radio is a really great example of something where as people got splintered and lived all over and don't live around their families, and they no longer share stories in an oral fashion, the radio kind of retrieves this idea of us all sitting around and listening to a story. So the radio has this ability to retrieve something that was lost in a prior era. And then his fourth one is to say, what does it reverse into? So with a car, even though it was made to connect us, there's a sense in which it kind of isolates us. It means that we live out in suburbs, and so when it's overused, it can reverse into something that's actually more negative, and maybe puts us like far back in the dark ages. Even though it has all kinds of benefits, it also can reverse into something that's kind of negative. So you can apply these four questions to anything. You can look at radio, television, film. You can look at hotels. You could look at pretty much anything and evaluate them on these four levels and find out a lot about them. So if we're going to look at the history of Bible technology, we want to look at, kind of go over the last 4,000 years in 15 minutes or so, and we'll apply some of those laws to some of those things, some of the things that happen in Bible technology. You guys all probably know there's basically about four stages of Bible technology. There was the oral stage that goes back as far as Adam and probably ends somewhere around 1500 BC. Then there's the written stage where the Bible begins to be written that ends somewhere around 1500 BC when the printing press is invented. And then there's a stage up until somewhere in the recent past where the Bible was printed. And then now it's in the digital stage. And at each of these big movements, there's inventions, there's all kinds of things that happen in society that shape the faith that we all have. And so we'll kind of walk through those things. So the first one is, of course, the oral Bible. And I put Bible in quotes because it's not really a written book at this point. But my wife and I, for example, to give you an idea of how it would have been in the oral Bible stage, the only thing that I can even think of that's even close to what this would have been like is that my wife and I have a few passwords that we know that only she and I know that we've never written down anywhere else. And so the data only exists on our minds. It's nowhere else to be found. And this is the whole way that everything was for thousands and thousands of years of human existence, depending on what view of Genesis 1 through 3 you take, right? So however long that was, that the community ended up being the sole device for storing any kind of tradition, any kind of story, anything. So you'd imagine that someone's mind would have been very, very sharp because there was no place to put it. I know when I'm kind of... I have a lot of things I need to do in a day. I instantly write down a to-do list because I always kind of, I just want to get it out of my mind and put it on a piece of paper because I feel like I can't remember it. But people in this day didn't have that option. All they could do is store it in their mind, and everybody in the community was responsible for storing the stories and the knowledge of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and all of those things. So we move on into the written Bible, which is this huge advance in technology. We sort of think of technology as all being digital stuff, but in this era, the written Bible was a huge technological advance. Of course, it allowed it to be more consistent, so all the stories that were told could be exactly written down. But it's also very, very costly to produce one of these scrolls, which means that the Bible itself is still the possession of a particular community. So that it's not something that each of us have our own, we don't have stacks and stacks of Bibles at our houses, but there's one Bible that the whole community would share. So a group like this, we might have one Bible, and the only time we ever hear it is on Saturday or Sunday morning But we don't have any other access to it. This is a really different world than all of us grew up in. And it seems really, really innocuous. But believe it or not, there was actually a lot of worry about whether or not writing was a good thing. And this is our friend Socrates, who's talking with Bill and Ted there. He was actually really worried about the technology of writing. And he chose not to write anything down that he worked on. He always wanted it to be in dialogue. He wanted it to be in discourse so that people would be thinking and it would lock into their minds. So he didn't write down anything. And his student Plato wrote down everything that he said. He actually tells this great story of the person who invented writing. He kind of made up this story. The person who invented writing brings it to this Egyptian king. And he says, I have this great invention. It's going to solve all the problems of memory and of wisdom. But the Egyptian king says, you know, I think it's going to be the opposite. I think what it's going to do is it's going to make it so that people read things, but they don't really know them. So it's going to make a kind of a form of wisdom, but not really true wisdom. So back in this day, there's people worried about whether or not this new technology of writing is really going to be good. It turns out that probably most of us would say that it really is a good technology, but it's interesting to think that 3,000 years ago or so, people were debating this. And it's also interesting to note that the alphabet itself is a technology that really shapes quite a bit of the way that we think. So for example, if you look at this word man, the letters there, the circles of the M and the A and the N, they don't really mean anything. We just kind of arrange them around. So if you have the word dog or the word God, you're just changing letters around and there's nothing in the letters themselves that communicate anything. It's 100% abstract. And we take a lot of meaning and we attach it to these symbols that don't mean anything. So we have another word like woman and there's no real other difference about that word either. But if we contrast that with a culture that doesn't have an abstract language, like an Eastern language, I hope you guys can see those characters. They look a lot different, and they actually communicate quite a bit about what a man is or what a woman is over in the Eastern world. And so those characters are no longer abstract, but they portray certain things through the idea of pictures. So the female form has some curves to it, and the male form has some sharp lines to it. And so this has led the West, those of us who use alphabets, Europe and all throughout that way, we think very abstractly. We think linearly. We think logically. But someone over the East doesn't necessarily think that exact same way. They're going to think more holistically. They're going to think more non-linearly. They're going to think of things like the yin and the yang symbol that we would never come up with in our sort of logical bullet point culture. So even the technology of language kind of shapes the way that we think, the things that we think about, the things that make sense to us. So if you're sharing the gospel in an Eastern context, it's going to take on a little bit different shape and a little bit different meaning than it would over in a Western context. To talk about a little bit about the way that the written scriptures looked, there was basically just preaching, there was hearing, and there was memorizing. That was really the whole interaction that people had with the scriptures. Someone would read a text, would exposit that text, and then you would go home and you would think about that text. That's the only thing that you had access to. And the only way that you got it was through the authority of the church. So this presents a really different scenario where if that authority starts to become corrupt, there's kind of a problem because only the authority owns the text. And there's one other thing that's worth mentioning, that in this day and age, this is the reason why all of the stained glass windows and all those things were built through the Christian history, is because that was one of the main things that people could access and that they could read. So a lot of theology is present in the images and the icons and the stained glass of the early church, because people couldn't read and they didn't have access to the scriptures, because it would have costed something like $50,000 to have a text, so no one would have it. And this is the reason why that story of the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts, when he's sitting there and he's reading a Bible and he's reading in Isaiah, that's a really radical story, because no one did that in that day. This is like a museum curator taking a very valuable piece of a very valuable artifact and just hanging out and reading it on his chariot. So that story is really kind of a random thing that you shouldn't really expect. To us, it seems normal, but in the context of that day, it would have been a really random thing. So along comes this huge invention. It's earth-shattering. It's called the printing press. And I know we all probably know a lot about this, but there are volumes of like 800-page books that talk about the effects of the printing press and how they've reshaped and altered our society. So a couple of the things, just to briefly mention, that it brings about a form of exactness that was never able to happen before. And that exactness allows the mass distribution to be able to go out and everybody can have a copy. And eventually this means that people can start referring to specific page numbers. So when you have a written text, the page numbers kind of change every time you write it, depending on how big the page is or how big your handwriting is. But now for the very first time, there's this concept of a page number that you can refer to. So if you want to say that page 7 of Plato's Republic, or page 97 of Augustine's Confessions, or page 1039 of Aquinas's Summa Theologica, you could do that, which you could never do before. This leads to the ability to have references and footnotes. And eventually people start wanting to do this with the scriptures too. They say, I want to be able to refer to specific passages, not just say the Apostle Paul said or as Isaiah said, but they want to be able to refer to exact things. So chapter and number and verses are added at this time frame. And of course the Masoretes had added them in the Hebrew scriptures, but the New Testament then got these around the 1600s or so. So this really brings up all kinds of crazy historical things, like the scientific revolution comes out of this because people were finally able to share data and share information and trade it and learn from one another. This creates all the political revolutions that formed the United States of America, because no longer is all the information stored in some kind of authoritarian structure, but now it's available to everyone. So people start wanting freedom and they start wanting to create countries with freedom. And of course, this also creates the Protestant Reformation that we all know about, that Martin Luther's Reformation. Of course, there had been reformations prior to that, all the way back as far as the 1200s. There were the Waldensians who said, man, the church in Rome is really kind of messing things up. But of course, they couldn't really spread their message, so it didn't go anywhere. But when Luther comes along, he's able to translate the Bible, translate or do his writings, put it out in the hands of the masses, and instantly the Reformation just takes off like a wildfire, all because of the printing press. So if we were to use Marshall McLuhan's four things, we would say again that the printed Bible, of course, really simply extends communication. But it makes obsolete the idea of communal or written knowledge. And it also makes obsolete the idea of any kind of need to have authority anymore that holds that information. But in a way, in a great way, it retrieves the access to truth that when there was an oral culture and everybody knew the stories, it retrieves that era where everybody has access to it. But unfortunately, it can also reverse into a form of radical individualism. So instead of hearing in community, instead of all of us together partaking from the scriptures, I can take a book and I can go in a corner and I can read it all by myself. I don't need any of you. I don't need your opinions. I don't need your thoughts. I don't need your authority. I don't need what you say. I can just go in the corner. I can come up with my own denomination. I can come up with my own doctrine. And I can come up with my own faith. And this is what we see come out of the Protestant Reformation. For all the greatness that it gives us a lot of things like the authority shifted from the church to the individual. So we all talk about ourselves doing individual interpretation. I went to seminary. I took 120 hours of coursework to learn how I could read the Bible for myself. This also leads to the concept of a personal Bible study or a quiet time, which I love and I'm so glad that I can do. I'm so glad that I can read the scriptures on my own. But it also means that my faith becomes very individualistic and also kind of logical, because I'm going to start thinking the way that print tells me to think. It tells me to think in logical ways. So we present the gospel as something where there's a fact, and then we have faith, and then we have feeling after that, because we're very insensitive to feeling because we're very logical and thorough. And we also tend to think about things in terms of verses. So we refer to exact verses and we pull them out of the argument that they're making, the discourse that's going on, the conversation that might be going on between two characters. We pull those individual verses out and we refer to them as specific things. So no longer is it a book with an argument, but a lot of times, and again, this isn't something that all of us do who are students, but this is society at large. Society at large is going to think of the scriptures as something of maybe just a bunch of little pieces of advice because of the technology of the printed scriptures and of the chapter and verse numbers that were added to those. So again, most of us may not think that way. We may be interested in literary and discourse analysis and all those kinds of things, but society at large, this is the effect that it's had. Now, on the move from print to digital, there's two gigantic or ginormous inventions that come along. The first one is the photograph, and the second one is the computer and the internet. So we're moving into this fourth stage of the digital Bible, but there's two big inventions we want to talk about. The first one is the photograph. And if we take this sort of this sentence that's composed of abstract characters, we can all picture maybe what that means. The boys are hungry. But if we saw this picture, that makes us laugh, right? It's sort of a funny interpretation of that sentence, you know, these little boys who are hungry. But of course, if we see this picture, it brings up a very different emotion in our minds of these boys being hungry. So Shane Hipps, in a book that I recommend you all read called Flickering Pixels, he would say, we normally say that a picture is worth 1,000 words, but it's probably more accurate to say that a picture is worth 1,000 emotions, because it conveys all of this kind of emotion and that kind of emotion, something that this sentence by itself can't really do because it's just an abstract thought. Now, if we get to the idea of a moving image that we see on the television, this is going to do something very different as well. Because it's so fast, it's going to tend to capture things that are a little bit more trivial, that aren't quite as important. So we see the trajectory of television sort of going toward reality TV. And even though there's a lot of educational programming, in general, television is moving this direction toward more and more trivial things because that's kind of what it's good at. It also becomes very, very entertaining. And the reason why this is kind of important is that if we were to go back 150 years and Abraham Lincoln was to walk across the street, none of us would recognize him. We'd be like, that's a cool top hat. I bet I could pull that off. That's about all we'd know how to do. Or that's a tall guy. But that's all we would know because we wouldn't recognize who he was. Now, if we open up a newspaper and we read something, we would probably be able to identify that it was Abraham Lincoln's writings because we had spent so much time reading. We had spent so much time listening to stump speeches that would be 3 hours long. On Sunday morning, we would go to Jonathan Edwards' church, and we would hear an hour-long discourse called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, and we would be perfectly capable of listening to that. But today, we're, in general, not able to do that because television in 1960, the average clip of a politician was 45 seconds. In 2000, it was 7 seconds. And so Neil Postman, in his book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, which talks about the television, he says that basically television has reduced political discourse to just entertainment. So I can recognize Barack Obama, I can recognize John McCain, I can recognize all kinds of political figures, but if I read something, I probably couldn't distinguish two politicians from one another, other than maybe their views, but between two Republicans and two Democrats, I'd have no idea what they were talking about, because I don't spend time reading long, complex texts. I spend time watching fast-moving images all day long. Now, of course, it's not all bad. I don't mean to portray the television as this evil death tube that sits in our room. It's not entirely bad. In a way, of all the logic that the print age brought, the television and the movies are able to sort of retrieve the sense of a sensitivity to story. So you see a lot of churches today no longer always preaching like 70,000 sermons through the book of Romans over like 7 years. You see them being more sensitive to story and more sensitive to the overall arc and narrative of the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. This has kind of recovered this sense in us of the importance of narrative and story. So it's not all bad. It's just that it's definitely not neutral in our lives. The second big thing is the computers or the internet. And this is a picture of Bill Gates lying on top of a computer from somewhere in the 70s. That's just a great picture, and I love it. And I love the word internets that our previous president coined. But the internets are a lot about, it's really, really good at transferring information. What happens, though, is that this information transfer, this blast of information all the time, tends to make us really good at scanning text. So when we read a blog post, for example, that's like 30 paragraphs, I just kind of scan it. I can't read this thing. If they at least have headings, I think I can maybe kind of digest it a little bit. And I noticed myself doing this, and so I looked at a couple popular blogs, TechCrunch and Engadget, two really popular blogs that I kind of have to look at for a living. And I counted up, I kind of wrote a little script to count up how many words they produce in a year. And I found out that the total words that TechCrunch produces is more than Plato's Republic, is more than Augustine's Confessions, is more than Aquinas' Summa Theologica, Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov, Faulkner's Light and August, the Old Testament and New Testament combined. All those things combined are fewer words than TechCrunch produces in a year. And I read like 30 blogs like TechCrunch. So my ability to look at information is just, it's just so fast it goes through. And I tried to put one of those daily Bible reading in my Google Reader. I just couldn't do it because all I would do is just scan it. And I didn't have the ability to sit down and read. And so for all the awesome things that the internet does. I mean, this is my job. I work on the internet as a living. But it also makes us kind of scanning people that sometimes can't sit back and look at text. It also makes us more sensitive to multitasking. So we want to do multiple things at once. I know if I bring my laptop into a talk, I'm probably going to want to try to shoot off an email or do something like that. And I found myself doing that in classrooms. And I know that if you were to go into a college classroom today, my wife is a college professor, she can attest to us that most of us probably try to multitask a lot. And some of us can do it sometimes, but a lot of times if I try to multitask while I'm watching my little son, I'm probably not going to do a real good job. He might, you know, fall off the table or something like that, which actually happened one time, sadly enough. So because I was trying to multitask, or if I try to text message while I'm listening to somebody. So multitasking is a really powerful thing, but I know that I usually have like 70 windows open on my machine, and sometimes I get less work done than if I just did one thing at a time. So now you see all these things like David Allen's Getting Things Done, all these tips and techniques to kind of push back the computer and all that it does. The other really fascinating thing is that our experience of language has moved to be something that we call decontextualized language. So when I was a kid, I learned little words, then I learned sentences and paragraphs, and the goal was to get up to a book level, to where I could read a 300-page book on a single topic. But we see this sort of reverse down to where from the book level, we go down to the article level, down to the blog post level, down to the comment, and down to the Twitter status update. It's not that the Twitter status update is bad, it's just that what I'm doing is I'm experiencing thousands and thousands and thousands of sentences with no argument around them. So just like I look at lots of verses like John 3:16 and I kind of don't know what's going on around it, I'm looking at all these individual status messages and individual small ideas that don't take place in the greater corpus of ideas like we used to. So again, computers and internets are really powerful and really awesome, and you can lay on them like Bill Gates did, but they also have a lot of kind of crazy things that maybe aren't always so positive. This is actually a quote from the CEO of Google, who could probably write a check today and solve all of our national debt problems. But this guy is saying, "I worry that the level of interrupt, the sort of overwhelming rapidity of information, and especially of stressful information, is in fact affecting our cognition. It is in fact affecting our deeper thinking. I still believe that sitting down and reading a book is the best way to learn something, and I worry that we're losing that." This guy's entire living is made on getting people on the computer, and he's saying, I think sometimes we need to get off the computer. Sometimes it's not always as positive as we think it is if we don't control it very well. It's not that it's good, it's not that it's bad, but it's definitely not neutral. So if we look at the digital Bible, and you guys all recognize this logo, right? Everybody knows what this is? Who is it? It's Logos, right? One funny thing to point out is that as we used to kind of look at stained glass windows and have real sensitivity to icons and images, then we went to a print culture, we're sort of going back to this image culture where we can show an icon and everybody knows exactly what it is. So we're kind of retaining this, or restoring this image culture. The digital Bible has all kinds of amazing things like increased access. It can be cheaper, it can be free when it's not shackled by lots of copyright problems. There's all kinds of cool ways to link information together. But there's some downsides to it. And I don't mean to at all be critical of the digital Bible because I use it all the time. But just to have us think about some of the things that we might want to have in our minds as we're developing all this software. In some ways, the Bible can become just information. We think of it as data that we process, that we put in a database and do all kinds of things to, and we kind of forget what it originally was. I'll give you an example of what can happen with the Bible as search. I know that Abraham grew up in a pagan family that didn't worship Yahweh, and I know that there's a verse somewhere in Joshua, but I know that verse has Abraham's dad's name in it, not Abraham's name. So I have to search for Abraham and find his dad's name, and then search for his dad's name in Joshua to find that verse that talks about how Abraham grew up in a pagan room, in a pagan family. So what happens is that I can't just remember the stinking verse in Joshua, but I can remember the search pattern that I did. And I know there's lots of things like that I know how to search for on Google, and that's great, but sometimes I need to commit those things to memory. And sometimes when I search for things, if I search for like God's love, I'll get these two verses. But these two verses are in vastly different literary contexts, making vastly different arguments. So sometimes this idea of search can pull us out of being sensitive to the scriptures in their original context. I know that some of us can often use tools as crutches. I know one of the talks yesterday from Jim and John They talked about how sometimes students end up using the Bible software a little bit as a crutch and not so much as a tool to learn. And so I'll show you that software again that we developed. But this can happen. And again, it doesn't happen with everybody in here, but it can happen on a larger scale. I go in the seminary coffee shop, and I see people just mousing over words. And then a couple years later, they don't really know the Greek and the Hebrew. And it's not the fault of the tool necessarily, but again, we wouldn't call the tool a neutral thing. So here are the recommendations I would give for us as a whole and then also for programmers. First off, just this idea that the mediums change but the message stays the same. This isn't really true. This isn't something that we should really go about spouting off, because mediums do alter the content. They do shape it. They do form it. They do inform it. They do take what someone hears and alters that a little bit. It's not that it's necessarily bad. It's not that it's making the gospel something that it's not, but it certainly is altering it. It's changing the emphasis. And we need to be aware of that as we move from, say, a sermon to a drama. Be aware of what those things are good at. I also think that it's really important for us to go back and to retain the idea that we should read Scripture aloud in community with other people, not always by ourselves in a corner, and not even with PowerPoint up on screen, but something where we have to close our eyes and we have to listen to it. Because this is what the church did for thousands of years. It's a recent phenomenon that we wouldn't just close our eyes and listen to the Scripture with our community under the authority of our church. So I would say, let's try to keep doing that. And then also for all of us, last night I looked at my Google feeder read and I had like 600 entries I hadn't read. I just had to kick them all off, because I knew there's no way I can do this and spend time with my family and all of those things. And I wanted to spend time reading through the Scriptures and memorizing large chunks like people did for thousands of years before they had stacks of Bibles that they didn't read in their houses. And for those of us who are programmers, some fun things we can do. We can try to enable our software to kind of reduce multitasking, to keep people focused on the thing that they're doing. We can create alternate experiences. We saw Steve Runge's talk yesterday where he talked about his discourse with all the icons and all that stuff. That's a really great way of being able to experience the Scriptures in a really contextualized format. Still using software, but doing it in a way that lets us see something different. And also, I guess there was the drama one that Jim Albright did yesterday as well, a different way of experiencing Scripture. So creating these alternate experiences. Also to create recommendations within our software so that we're not always dumping tons and tons of information on them, but saying, hey, this really is the best source. If you've got 30 different Bible dictionaries in your software, maybe kind of say which one is the best one. Say which one is better so that someone doesn't spend all their time going through information that isn't really good. And then also, if you can, minimize the number of helps that are available, or at least allow them to be turned off. And that was the idea behind this software, so that someone could go in here and turn off as many things that they didn't need, and turn off all these things. If they didn't feel like they were going to need those things, they could just have it plain and not do all this stuff, but just have the definitions that they shouldn't have memorized. So it's a minimalist approach to technology that allows someone to really engage in learning and really stick with the text. And this isn't entirely unprecedented. I know there was a big game of Rock Band last night, right? And if any of you guys have ever played a game on the Nintendo Wii, if you play that for more than 30 minutes, do you know what it does? It says, hey, you need to go outside. Because this multi-billion dollar company is recognizing this might not be all the time the best thing to do for hours and hours and hours on end. So even though it would be monetarily advantageous for Nintendo for you to play it all day, they're telling you, stop using this thing. And so sometimes we need to do the same thing. We need to go back to what the Scriptures were in their original context. Keep using your Bible software. Keep developing it, you awesome Logos guys. But sometimes let's go back to what the Scriptures were in the beginning. Thanks so much. If you want to email me, I'm at johndyer@gmail.com. And I have a code blog at johndyer.name because I couldn't get .com. And if you ever want to go to .com, it's a hilarious guy that goes to the Burning Man and does lots of fun stuff. And then I also have a Theotech blog called DonateTheFruit.com. So thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'd love to take them.
So many of the yet unreached peoples in the world are still largely oral in terms of how they interact with Scripture in the sense of either non-literate or pre-literate. Mm-hmm. So some of those, like up until 1500 BC, some of those cultures have retained some of that. Is there any kind of issues to address there, or the kind of tech energy and intelligence we have applying it to their...
Yeah, there's a missiologists or people that study missionary things. They talk a lot about how when you introduce an alphabet to a culture and you introduce written text to them, it does start to alter things and makes them have to get more and more kind of high tech, and it comes into a society, even though we think, gosh, having a written scriptures would be the thing, it really begins to alter and reshape the rest of their society, sometimes in ways that are really hard to deal with. It takes a couple generations for them to really be able to make sense of this new world. Just like it took the West hundreds of years to make sense of having the printing press, it will often take a culture that is an oral culture a while. So I've heard, I think even here, of some software tools to help retain that sense of orality so that the culture doesn't have to radically change so fast by introducing all this foreign technology there. You can bring the scriptures in without necessarily bringing in all the technology. So, yeah.
I appreciate what you said, even though I didn't hear
Oh, sure.
I do appreciate what you're saying about it's easy for us to be excited about the technology,
yeah,
and people who think the same way we are,
yeah,
doing and are working on similar projects, and the technology itself is so neat.
Yeah.
We can do this in the future and this in the future, and we can easily forget about the magnificence and the holiness of this mighty, mighty God, huge magnificence and holiness, and just lose that somehow in what we're doing, and forget that that's why we're doing it.
Yeah. There's sometimes a belief that if we just had more technology that things would get solved, whereas in reality the course of history is kind of ends at the nuclear bomb, right? This high-tech world, we just kind of, there's always going to be that human depravity kind of element to things, so that for every gain we get, there's also a loss. And the way that Postman words this is that every technology is a trade-off of some kind, so that we need to recognize the benefits, since things like medical technology, gosh, there's no way I'd want to do without that. But there's also a lot of trade-offs with our current healthcare that we have today. So I think trying to keep our hope in the words of the gospel. Remember that statement where Jesus says, you search the scriptures because you think in them you find eternal life? And he says, remember, the scriptures point to me. And just remembering that can be helpful so that we can be excited about, I love my iPhone. I can't wait to get my new Dell in a few months. I mean, I'm excited about that. I still love the Apple IIe that my dad brought home 25 years ago. But I still, my hope is still in Christ. And I still believe that that not just the data of Scripture, but what it, but who it points to is the powerful thing. Anything else? Well, thanks so much, guys. I really appreciate you guys having me.